Welcome to Sophisticated Property Investing, a podcast brought to you by Ethical Property Partners, the experts in sophisticated property investment.
Hello, this is Pete. I am one of the content producers here at Ethical Property Partners. As well as a podcast, we have our YouTube channel, and one thing that's been working brilliantly over there are our Sophisticated Saturdays. Now, this episode includes audio from a Sophisticated Saturday show where you'll hear about a deal that Frank has recently done. In the first part, you'll get all the numbers, so if you want to take part and work out how you'd do the deal, you can grab a calculator and make some notes before listening to the second part, where Frank will tell you exactly how he structured the deal in a sophisticated way. The third and final part is exclusive to you as a podcast listener, where Frank gets grilled by an expert investor and chats about the deal in more detail. So over to Frank.
So today I'm giving you a red hot deal that I only spoke to the vendor about a few days ago, and I thought I would share it with you as a challenge. So it's quite a complicated deal, so you might want a pen and paper because I've got all my notes written down here to share with you. So this vendor is, I'd say, in his 70s. I think he said he was in his 70s. He's been a successful landlord, got a portfolio, but he's basically, and he said it himself, he wants to free up his time. He doesn't want to be spending time looking after tenants, dealing with compliance issues, dealing with local councils, licensing, etc., etc. He's got five properties in London that he wants to sell. Now, the rough numbers on these, I'm not going to go through all five because it'd get a bit tedious, but roughly speaking, they're all worth around 450,000, a couple of them a bit less, a couple of them a bit more. Now, this is really important. When you're structuring a deal, it's important to look at the whole of the deal, all of the properties. So the fact that some of them are a little bit more, some of them a little bit less, is relevant. But for this exercise, I'm going to assume they're all 450,000. Now, they've got varying mortgages on them, some up to 70% loan to value, and some down as low as 60% loan to value. So roughly speaking, they're all at about 65% loan to value, but there is a little bit of difference there. Net profit, so gross profit on this, is just over £200,000. Net profit is around £80,000 a year. Now, there's quite a large capital gains tax liability on this portfolio, so the landlord is aware of that. He'd like to mitigate that if he can. There may be something you can come up with that would help them with that. And also, the landlord would like around £100,000 from this portfolio. So he's not interested in a 75% purchase. He's not interested in that because he loses so much equity. If you work that out, it's masses. It's a few hundred thousand pounds he'd be losing. He does have a capital gains tax liability on the portfolio. He's had the portfolio for quite some time, and he wants at least £100,000 now. Not because he needs the money, interestingly, but because he would like some skin in the game. And so what questions would you ask of the landlord, of the vendor? What else do you need to know? After the break, I'll tell you how I offered on this portfolio. The vendor said yes, in principle, we're going to legals now. As I say, it's a red hot transaction. It's been agreed, and so I'll see you after the break.
This is the Sophisticated Property Investing Podcast. To see more about our Sophisticated Saturdays, just search YouTube for Ethical Property Partners.
Hey guys, welcome back. So how did you structure this transaction? What did you ask the vendor? What additional questions? Well, the great thing about our Sophisticated Saturday podcasts and YouTube episodes, we do these in both formats now, these challenge sessions. The great news about these is that we actually, on the podcast, get interviews. I get interviewed by our country owners, our EPP country owners, actually dissect each one of these transactions and ask me questions about why did you do this, why didn't you do this, etc. And so if you have questions that you think, Frank, you didn't answer that in the episode, then listen into the podcast, because the likelihood is that they'll actually be asked by the MFA, the Master Franchise Area owners, for the different countries, and then you can get the answers that you're after. Failing that, pop them in the comments section and one of my team will answer them. So how did you offer on this property? How did you decide to monetize it? Well, it's already quite profitable in terms of, you know, 80 odd thousand pounds a year, so that's great. There may be some opportunities to develop some of them. There are actually some lapsed planning permissions in place for some development, so that's all a bonus. But the priority here is getting the properties into our permanent control, and that's what we're always looking to do. It doesn't matter if we own them now, so long as we control them now, but we must own them at some point. That's my big bugbear with rent to rent. I have no problem with rent to rent as a job, but it's not investing, because investment is controlling assets that generate passive income or highly leveraged income, whereas rent to rent, you're working really hard and earning a decent income. So it's a job and it can help people to escape their 9 till 5, but it can be taken away from you because you don't control the assets permanently. So in this transaction, I need to control the assets permanently. And so I had an open and honest conversation with the vendor, understood what he was after. He wants freedom from his portfolio, but he wants market value for them. He's had them valued, and as I say, we're working on the basis of about £450,000 of property. And so it came down to, how much are we going to pay him a month? How long are we going to do this transaction over? I've mentioned they're in London. And how much are we going to pay him up front? And once you answer those three questions, you've basically got your offer. Now, did you write down how long is left on the mortgages? Because that is critical here. If the mortgages have only got 2 or 3 years left, I spoke to a vendor this morning, there's only 2 years left on the mortgage. In fact, there's only 18 months left on that mortgage. There's very little we can do, because we either need the vendor to refinance now, or we need to buy in 18 months' time. So you have to know how long is left on the mortgage. You also need to know whether there's any penalty clauses for terminating the mortgage early and repaying it, and whether it's on a fixed rate or variable that's likely to revert to a standard variable rate later on. I think they've changed the name to reversionary rate, I don't know why, but basically the standard variable rates of the lenders do vary, and they can change them at a whim if it's in their terms and conditions, so just be aware of that. So the answer to that is, this particular landlord has over 15 years on all of his mortgages, which is great. Because it's in London, because we're anticipating decent capital growth over the next few years, my offer to him was a 10-year agreement. Control now, pay later over a 10-year agreement. He wanted £100,000, so what I suggested was, on one of the properties, and I asked the landlord, I said, which property would give you the most money in your pocket if you're after £100,000? And he said, well, actually, there's this one, it's worth £450,000. I only owe £300,000 on it, and I don't have any capital gains tax, or there's a very small capital gains tax liability. So that would be a really good one, because some of the others, there's a large capital gains tax liability on them. And so what I said was, brilliant, we'll buy that from you at market value. Now you might be thinking, hang on, Frank, what are you doing? Why are you paying market value? Well, of course, if I pay market value for this one, the other four, I'm getting a really good deal on, and overall, that's a great deal. So one I'm just going to buy at market value. He actually said, how about you buy one, and then if that goes well at market value, I'll sell you the other four. Well, with the greatest of respect to the vendor, I can't risk that, because I could end up buying a property and then him not selling the other four. So I said to him, we need to do all five simultaneously. He said, I understand that, no problem at all. So I'm going to buy one at market value. I'm going to have to put in a sizable deposit. So if it's £450,000, I'm going to have to put in 25%. So I'm putting in whatever that ends up being. It probably end up being about £150,000 by the time I've put a 25% deposit in. That'd be 100K, 100 and a bit. Then you've got stamp duty, etc. But if that means that I could do the other four on a control now, pay later strategy, then we're laughing. And so what I decided is to offer him 2/3 of the cash flow of the rest of the portfolio. So if there's £80,000 split between the five properties, obviously 20% of that will come to me on my own, so I get £16,000, because that's the profit on the one that I'm buying, so that's mine. But that leaves £64,000 split across the other four. And so I'm going to give him 2/3 of that, so 2/3 of 60K is £40,000, £43,000, something like that. And I'm gonna get the balance. So I'm gonna get the balance of 43 to 64, which is £21,000 per year for basically just putting in my 150K into this transaction. So I've got 16K and I've got 21K. That's a total of £37,000 return on 150K. And what I know I can do, and you might be thinking, yeah, but that's not a great return, Frank. It's not. I completely agree, because we have our golden rule at EPP, which is to get all of our money out within the first year. That's what we aim to do. If you think about it, 30 plus thousand pounds on a £150,000 investment is not all of your money out in 1 year. It's actually a 20% return, which means it's going to take you 5 years to get all of your money out. Not fantastic at all, except if it's not your money. And that's how I'm going to solve this. So I'm going to bring in a JV partner and I'm going to say to them, look at this deal. We've got four properties here that we're securing at today's prices for £1 each. Four properties in London, they're tenanted, we've got accounts. What do you think they'll be worth in 10 years' time? Well, here's the thing. We can secure them at today's prices. We'll actually exchange contracts. That's what I said to the guy. We need to simultaneously exchange on all five and we'll complete on the fifth one at the same time. So we'll have four exchanges and one completion. And then to my finance investor, I'm gonna say, look, we will benefit from the capital growth over four properties over the next 10 years. How amazing is that? And all we've got to do is buy one property today that's a good return, that's a decent yield on a full market value property. In fact, is it a single let or HMO? It's a HMO property, so it's got a decent ROI on that particular property as well. So that's not a bad return at all. 10% for the investor, because they are getting a 10% cash on cash return on a London property is pretty awesome. Awesome, but also I'm gonna manage it for them, so that's pretty good for them. So it's a passive investment for them. But instead of seeing the normal return that they'd see on one property, capital return, as capital growth kicks in, they're gonna see capital growth on five properties. Now, admittedly, they're gonna share half the cash flow with me, so I'm getting £15,000 a year, and they're gonna share half the capital growth. But it's still a brilliant deal for the investor. And so I typically will go to my franchisees first and offer this to them, and if they're not interested or there's not an appetite for it, I'll then go to some of my high net worth individuals that just want fantastic deals to do. Now for me, how much money am I putting into this? Zero. I'm not putting the 150 in. Yes, I'm gonna manage the properties, but that's fine. I can get a letting agent to do that down in London for me. I get £15,000 a year from the five properties in cash flow, and none of that is a return on investment. It's an infinite return on investment because I haven't put any money into the deal. And over the next 10 years, I'm gonna hopefully see fantastic capital growth. If I don't see capital growth, we've got an assignable exchange of contracts, which means that if we don't see a huge capital growth, we can just sell these properties on. So we can just sell them on to waiting investors if they only got by 5% in 10 years. Pretty unlikely to only see 5%, especially when we've seen 7, 8% in the last year, although not in London. But I would argue if we've seen a drop in prices in London in the last year, then that gives more opportunity for growth over the next few years. But if you came up with a solution like that, congratulations. I think it's a good win-win. The vendor has agreed to it in principle. We're just waiting on his accounts to verify his numbers, etc. But he's agreed in principle. I know I can raise the 150K from a investor of mine and it works. If you came up with a better solution, then fantastic, bounce it off me. If it's better for you and better for the vendor, great. If it's better for the vendor but worse for you, maybe you want to consider modifying it. If it's better for you but not as good for the investor, then maybe you want to consider whether the investor would actually go for it. But hopefully, guys, that gave you an insight into a real life deal that we met with the vendor on just this week. Hey, ladies and gents, and welcome back to the second part of this Sophisticated Saturday podcast. So I have
set out the challenge for you. You have hopefully come up with your own solution, worked out what questions you'd ask the vendor. Then I've given you the solution that I came up with, that we came up with together to solve this transaction and how we monetized it. And now Liz Strama here from HQ, Global HQ, is here to ask the questions that she has about this transaction and also hopefully the questions that you might be thinking yourself. So Liz, without further ado, over to you.
Oh, good morning. So yeah, this is a really interesting deal. And so I've got a few questions, which I'm sure lots of other people have had running through their mind as well. So the first one is, when you were outlining the deal at the start, you mentioned the vendor wants to minimise his capital gains tax. Has he been able to do that? And if so, how?
It's always a tricky one, capital gains tax. There's a few strategies that we can use, but we're not tax advisors, and we always say this to our vendors. If you're buying 5 properties, the obvious way to maximize the vendor's capital gains tax allowance is to buy them in 5 different tax years, and then the vendor will get his capital gains tax allowance each year. The fact that you might be entering into an agreement to buy those properties earlier is neither here nor there. So you could take control of all 5 now, but complete on them one this year, one next year, one the year after, etc. And he could actually get 5 times his capital gains tax allowance. And if he's married, then that's 10 capital gains tax allowances, which, you know, each capital gains tax allowance at the moment is about £12,500. That's £25,000 a year times 5. That's £125,000 tax free. So it's worth doing. But there are quite a few complexities. So if you exchange contracts and you receive the keys, then that is very similar to owning the property. And there are some taxes. It's called specific performance. So are you acting as though you own the property? If you are, then HMRC would say that capital gains tax is payable now, as is stamp duty. So the two are very closely linked. So it's very important that you, as the purchaser, seek professional advice on your tax situation. Now, I hesitated because I've asked lawyers the question and they've said, oh, that's a question for your accountant. And I've asked accountants the question. They've said, well, that's a question for your lawyers. So it is a tricky situation. And I've actually had conflicting advice from 2 solicitors on the same transaction. That's how grey an area it is. And so I always err on the side of caution, get my advice in writing from my solicitor or from my accountant, and then rely on that advice. And if HMRC ever come knocking, you say, well, I checked with my professional advisor, this is what they said, here's their advice, and I've followed it to the letter. If HMRC accept that, then great. If they don't and they penalise you in some way, then obviously you've got the professional indemnity insurance of that professional advisor that you can rely on. So you're kind of bulletproof from that perspective. This particular investor wasn't massively motivated about the £125,000 tax free. And the reason for that, i.e. using all of his capital gains tax allowances, it really wasn't very much money to him in the scheme of his properties. So they've made a lot of money. He's had them a long time. They're very expensive properties. And so for him, 25 grand tax free was not a biggie. He owned them all personally. As time goes by, more and more vendors will own investment properties corporately. So they'll own them in limited companies. And of course, there's no capital gains tax issue then. It's just a trading profit issue. So that's done and dusted. But if you are buying properties from private individuals, then you always want to look for opportunities to maximize their capital gains tax allowances and minimize their capital gains. And one way that I've done that in the past, and this may be the solution that the accountants come up with on this one, is to buy an option agreement from the investor. And so you can buy an option to buy the property later for £25,000. And that, of course, is a tax-free payment that you can make to them because they had a piece of paper that was worth 1p and then you did some writing on it and turned it into an option agreement and both signed it, and now it's worth £25,000. And that is a capital gain on that piece of paper. People often miss that capital gains happen in many different ways. Classic cars, stamps, coin collections, etc. So not just in property. And so you can use that capital allowance in that year. And of course, that 25 grand can come off the purchase price later. So it achieves the same outcome. But you do need professional advice in this area. You want to be making sure you do everything by the letter of HMRC's rules, because you don't want to fall foul of any of their guidance or regulations, etc. But those are the kind of opportunities that there are to maximize an investor's capital gains tax allowance. Now, the question I asked to my accountant, and this is where experience and professional advice is so valuable. That deal that I just described, where I bought the option for 25 grand, that was something like a 10-year deal. And I said, how about we make it a 12-month option and let it expire? And then I buy another one for 25 grand the next year and let it expire. And I'll do one for 10, I'll do 10 consecutively. And then I'll buy the property for a pound and I've got the property for, I've paid, you know, the money over time, and the investor won't pay a penny in capital gains tax. and the clever thing on that was, you don't actually have to pay the 25 grand. You can have the vendor lend you 25 grand and then you pay them 25 grand in for the option. So no money actually changes hands if you're thinking, oh, I need loads of money each year. And my accountant turned around and said, Frank, by the letter of the law, that's absolutely fine. But I think HMRC will look through that and say, do you know what? These are all linked. You're having a laugh. We'll take the full capital gains tax. Whereas his advice was, that's reasonable. You're buying a 10-year option. You are paying for the option now, even though the vendor's lending you 25 grand. That's a separate transaction. That's fine. This is his advice, not mine. And then you're going to buy the property and the investor will pay capital gains tax on the property. So there's an element of trying to be clever, but also making sure that you're within what's allowed and within what's reasonable. And so will we mitigate some of this vendor's capital gains tax? Yes. Is he willing to jump through a few hoops to save it? I don't think he is, actually, which is fine. That just keeps the transaction nice and simple.
And there's certainly lots of options when the vendor seems quite flexible, which is great. So you compared rent to rent to being like a job in the video. So you said you avoid those deals, but is there a situation where you would use rent to rent as a solution?
Yeah. I've probably been a bit harsh on rent to rent over the years, and you know, rent to rent was everyone's favourite strategy 5 years ago, 6 years ago. It still seems to be peddled quite a lot. I think it's because it's not really regulated. It's very easy to spin it as, you know, you don't need to apply for mortgages, so you don't need credit, you don't need any deposits. You know, it's easy to sell rent-to-rent courses. And because so many people have, in my opinion, missold those courses, then I've come down quite hard on rent-to-rent. And of course, there's, you know, nothing's all good or all bad. And so I have done some rent-to-rent deals. I did, how many? Two or three a few years ago, pure rent-to-rent deals. And just to see what everyone was, you know, shouting about and to see what kind of money I could make. I did it in one of the most, in inverted commas, one of the best rent-to-rent areas of the country. And I think we about broke even. We might have made a bit of money, but it was nowhere near worth our time and effort. The rule I made for myself at that point and my recommendation now to all my clients is only do rent to rent if you have permanent control of the property. And so a lot of these strategies overlap. So if you do an exchange or delay completion, very rarely will you exchange now and complete in 10 years and not have anything to do with the property in the interim. Normally, you'll exchange now, take keys now, and monetize that property for the 10 years. Well, if you think about that, that's just rent to rent for 10 years. You're paying an amount each month. Normally, you're paying an amount each month. And then you're monetizing it at a higher level. If you were monetizing at a lower level, you'd be losing money. So you're basically doing rent to rent. But the difference is you've exchanged contracts and you've got a fixed completion date and a fixed purchase price. Same with a back-to-back lease option. That's really just rent to rent, but with some options to buy in thrown in there as well. So would I do rent to rent? Yeah, I will. If the landlord is never able to take the property back from me, because if I sign up to a 3-year rental agreement, for example, from the landlord, and let's, you know, put to one side that their mortgage probably won't allow it, and if they're breaking the terms of their mortgage, then the property is not insured. That's typically what will happen. And so let's just forget for a second that it's an uninsured property that's in contravention of its mortgage terms and conditions, which probably makes it unlicensable. You know, you can see how rent to rent starts to unravel. This really simple thing that has no compliance actually has quite a lot of compliance involved in it. Now, of course, it might be a cash purchase property with no mortgage, so it's unencumbered, or the mortgage lender might give consent for a 3-year rental agreement, etc., or subletting. But often that isn't the case, and people are just hoping it'll be fine, which is fine until the property burns down and then you're uninsured. And I actually have had a property burn down, and I've been through the very detailed questioning that the insurance company went through, because I think it was a £25,000 claim. Now, that wasn't the whole value of the property. The 4 external walls and the roof were still on it, but the interior had basically burnt out. We needed to take it back to brick and redo it as a small house. But I don't want to ever go through that process again and hope that they don't find something. I'm making sure that every single one of my transactions is in compliance with the mortgage, it's in compliance with the insurance, it's in compliance with all licensing, because I know that they were looking for every opportunity. They sent in every opportunity not to pay. They sent in a forensic fire inspector. He spent 2 hours in the property in his overalls and his mask doing tests. And I'm convinced they were looking for accelerants. I'm convinced they were suspecting arson. But of course, it all came back clear, because it was just a very unfortunate accident. It was the guy had gone into hospital and left his, bizarrely, a radio, a plug-in radio that had malfunctioned, like a really old one. And it smouldered and smouldered, and because no one was in the house, it burst into flames at some point. So, yeah, I think the problem with rent to rent is you take a property and take, for example, a 3-year lease on it or a 3-year rental agreement, and then start monetizing that property at a higher level, whether you do rent to SA, so you let it as a holiday let, or whether you do a rent to rent with a HMO agreement. But whatever you do, you're showing the owner of the property what they're missing out on. And if you've given them a break clause, they can exercise that break clause. And if you haven't given them a break clause at the end of the agreement, they can not renew it. And then they can just carry on the property. And people say, oh yeah, but you take the fire doors out and you take the furniture out. And do what with it? You know, it's more costly to take fire doors out than to just leave them in. It's more costly to take furniture out and store it than to just leave it in the property, in my experience. And so you're, in a way, taking a poorly performing investment, showing the owner how well it can perform, and then hoping they're going to allow you to reap the benefits forevermore. And in my experience, that rarely happens. Of course, there are examples of that. But in my experience, if you've exchanged on it or you've got an option to buy it, you know you're going to make that money forevermore. So I think that's the only instance where I'd now consider doing rent to rent, Liz.
So you mentioned the time left on the mortgage for these properties was around 15 years, but you structured the deal over 10 years. So was there a reason why you didn't structure it over 15 years to coincide with the mortgage term?
Yeah, you're exactly right, or the insinuation that you're making is exactly right, Liz. Usually we would do a deal over the term of the mortgage. Why not? But you get a feel for investors and you get a feel for their level of motivation, their time frames. That's the benefit of having a long conversation with them. Interestingly, I negotiated this one over Zoom, but the investor was of an age where I thought anything beyond 10 years, I really don't like doing shorter than 10 years. I have done shorter than 10 years, but anything over 10 years is a bonus, really. And we've done 15-year ones. I don't think I've done one above 15 years yet. There's always a first. But I just thought that 10 years was a really good deal for us. You know, where it is in the country, expected capital growth, the monetization on it, how much we're going to make over the 10 years. I thought it was a fair compromise. So would I have gone for 15 years? Absolutely. But that would have increased the chances of us not doing the deal. And I'd rather be fair and get a good deal than shoot for the stars and either achieve a win-lose. So, you know, we win, brilliant deal for us, but not a great deal for the vendor, or risk the vendor saying no. Because a vendor can say yes at the start, and then once they go through it, end up with a no. So that's the balance. And that's what I'm judging, very finely judging, whilst I'm in that help visit, whether it's in person or on Zoom. How motivated is the vendor? Where does that win-win sit for me? Where does it sit for them?
And if the vendor did only have 2 years left on the mortgage, which I know he didn't, but if he did, would you still have been able to offer a solution, and what would that have looked like?
Yeah, we're doing one like this at the moment, actually, where there's, I can't remember the exact numbers, but the properties are in an area very different to this one. They're in an area of very low capital growth. I want to say there's 3 or 4 years, maybe even 2 years on the mortgages. I want to say there's 8 or 10 properties that we're looking to do. In fact, I think we might be doing an episode on this shortly. The problem with that is there's nowhere near enough time for that capital growth. And so you have to look at a different solution. And one solution, the obvious solution, is to extend the mortgages. So you can write into the agreement that the vendor has to refinance. And if they refinance onto a new 20-year agreement, then all of a sudden you've got 22, 23 years instead of 2 or 3 years. So that's the easy solution. If the lender won't extend, and you can't know that at this stage, so it means you're stuck to that time frame. If the properties don't have the equity in them for the vendor to sell at a below market value price, so if there's 75% loan to value and there's 25% equity, then you can just buy them today. The fact that the vendor might want a bit more money for the properties is fine. You know, in 3 years' time, you might be able to give them a bit more money, or the property might cash flow enough that you could give a bit to them of that cash flow at the end. So that's one solution. You can bring the date forward and drop the price. But if, for example, it was 100% loan to value, then there's no equity in it. So you can't buy it at 75%. And if the mortgage is ending shortly, you know, 2 or 3 years, then you can't allow for capital growth to kick in. And that's where deals get really hard to solve. We have the ethos and the saying on EPP that no deal crosses our desk without us monetizing it. And I like that. I like that challenge of, this is a motivated vendor, how can we help? And in fact, that's one of our questions in the telephone fact finder, isn't it? How can I help? But it actually is a very simple equation. Either we buy below market value, or we take control of the property, responsibility for the property now, and pay over time. So control now, pay later. If neither of those are possible, which is what you're outlining there, Liz, there's only really one other solution, and that's to raise the value of the property. Because if you can raise the value of the property high enough, and because the way the maths works, you've got to add a third to the property's value in order to then buy it at 75% loan to value. So if you think of a 100 grand property, if it's worth 100 grand today, so if you've got a mortgage that's ending in 12 months, okay, there's nothing you can do in 12 months. And I sometimes see novice investors say, I've got a 6 months EDC. And I'm like, wow. So what's going to magic itself up in 6 months? There's nothing, you know. And they're like, well, I heard you did a 10-year one. I'm like, yeah, well, a lot happens in 10 years. Properties go up in value. You save a lot of rent money. You know, what's going to happen in your 6 months? Nothing. You're just going to be stuck with a property you can't buy. And so let's just put it as a 12-month mortgage term remaining. So you can't do any control now, pay later. But you do have 12 months to change the value of the property, and we'll come back to that. You can't buy a below market value price, because if it's worth 100 grand, let's just keep the maths easy. You only want to buy it at 75 or lower, but they owe 100 on it. So that's not going to work. So the only way you can solve that problem for them is assuming the mortgage lender won't extend, and assuming they have to repay their mortgage, etc., is for you to raise the value of that property up to £133,000, because then the 75% becomes the 100 grand. And you might think, well, how can you just add 33 grand to a property value? But that is your plan C, if you like. So plan A is buy it now at 75. Plan B is buy it at some point in the future, 10, 15 years time at 100. Or get it up to 133 now and pay 100 for it. And so the way to get it up to 133 now is by doing something like planning gain on it. So perhaps getting planning permission for a property for development in the garden, for example, or perhaps by title splitting, or perhaps by extending the property, or perhaps by adding value, substantial value in some way. Those are really the only three options you have. And as soon as you start thinking along those lines, if you're in a conversation with a vendor and they don't like number one, or they aren't able to do number one by now at a BMV price, they don't like, or they can't do number two, control now, pay later, and the property doesn't lend itself to adding significant value quickly, you basically know that that's a deal that can't be done.
And your plan for this particular deal is you're going to complete on the first property at market value, so the 450, and you're going to simultaneously exchange on the other four properties at the same time, so you can protect yourself at the future buy price. But that's going to attract extra costs on exchange, such as stamp duty, you know, extended legal costs, that kind of thing. How are you going to cover those costs?
The stamp duty is, as I said earlier, is a grey area. So I will be taking legal advice on, is stamp duty payable upon exchange? There are instances where it is. There are instances where it isn't. I'll also be taking advice on, and this is the thing, we are generalists. We're not specialists. We know a bit about conveyancing. We know a bit about accounting. We know a bit about property tax. We know a bit about planning. We know a bit about building, et cetera, et cetera. And so your little black book of professionals is absolutely critical in this. So the first thing, and this is really important when negotiating with a vendor, is to agree what you want to happen. He wants 450 now, and then he wants to sell the others at X amount each over a period of 10 years. He wants to hand over the keys now. He's happy with X amount a month. That's the what. Once you've agreed that, you then move on to the how. How are you going to structure it? Because the how gets really complicated sometimes, and it's important to get it right. And so will we be paying stamp duty on all these properties? If we have to, then of course we will. Is that worth it? Yeah, of course it will be. It'll be worth it to someone. Will I be putting in a few £100,000 of stamp? No, I won't. But I might JV with a partner on this, and they put that in, and then they get these properties in 10 years time, you know, 50-50 with me. This deal will end up being no money down for me. I often say, in fact, I was interviewed by Amanda Jarvis Dore recently, where she said, you know, should you get the property first and the vendor first, or should you find the money first? Always the property and the vendor, because if the deal's good enough like this one, you know, if this deal goes ahead, then I'll be able to find the money to buy it. More likely we won't have to pay stamp now, but again, we'll take our advisor's advice on it. I'll also be looking at any kind of relief from buying multiple properties. So there's relief if you buy multiple properties from the same vendor in a linked transaction, so that might be an opportunity there, etc., etc. So those are, yeah, real considerations, Liz. So we'll have legal costs. Now legals won't be massive on this, you know, if it's five properties, that's probably going to cost 15 grand, 10 grand, something like that. I don't think we've offered to pay his legal, so yeah, it might be close to 10. And then we've got, stamp would be significant on this if it's payable on all of them now. And that's where the lawyers and the accountants sometimes have to work together. And we often have to be the bridge between the two, or the translators between the two, because I will say to the accountants, how can we do this deal without paying stamp? Because stamp is X amount, you know, it could be 100K on this quite easily. And so my first question to the accountant will be, how can we legally avoid paying 100K stamp duty now? And it may be that they put in place a management agreement rather than an exchange of contracts. And that's where We talk generically about doing these deals, you know, an EDC, but actually when it comes to it, does it matter if it's an exchange of contracts? Is it okay if it's a management contract instead with an option to buy at the end? Yeah, I couldn't care less what the bit of paper says. If that means I don't have to stump up a load of stamp duty now, then that's great. If it means I don't have to give half away to an investor who's going to put in the stamp duty now, then that's great as well. And that's where the accountant will say, well, can we do this? And the lawyers will say, no, we can't really do that because that doesn't give Frank enough protection. And I'll say, yeah, but what about if we did it this way? And they go, oh yeah, that might work. You know, I've had vendors before now say, oh, we don't want to do an option because we don't want you to walk away. And I said, well, what about if we put a penalty payment in? So if at the end of the option I don't exercise it, how about I have to give you 20 grand? And they're like, oh yeah, I'll be all right with that. And so people get very railroaded in their thinking, very blinkered in their thinking of sometimes going, well, an exchange with late completion is this, and an option to buy is this, and a rent-to-rent agreement is this. And actually, they're just all blended together, and your job is to pick out the elements and modify them and tweak them to make them perfect for the deal you're doing. So that's the process that we'll be going through once we've agreed the what. And so it has to be agreed what's going to happen first. What does the vendor want to happen? What do we want to happen in terms of money and control, etc.? And then how do we protect the vendor? Because there's no smoke and mirrors here. We're looking for a win-win where we protect them and we're protected as well. So how do we protect their interests in every eventuality? And how do we protect our interests? And so long as we've got a clear what, the how becomes evident later.
And realistically, how much do you expect property prices to increase over 10 years? I'm expecting you to look at your crystal ball here. And when you complete on the four properties in 10 years' time, are you planning to obtain mortgages with quite a low loan to value because of the increased equity? Or would you be looking to release as much equity as possible when you get the mortgage?
Wow. What a good question, Liz. There's a few elements to this. So please come back. If I miss it off, Liz, please come back to the what kind of mortgages will I get? You know, how much equity in that? Because I think there's a massive learning there that many experienced investors miss. And in fact, you're rapidly building your portfolio at the moment, Liz. How many? So we're recording this end of July. How many properties have you purchased this year?
Three at the beginning of the year. We've got five going through. No, we just completed on another one last week, so that's four. So we'll be at about eight in the next 4 weeks. And then obviously we've got from August to the end of December, where I expect the market will pick up for us.
Eight going through or completed and going through, and then two, four more through the end of the year. So you're building at a steady rate at the moment, which is fantastic. You're building your portfolio. This that how to mortgage your properties is very relevant to you. So we'll come on to that in a minute. But before we come on to that, the first part of your question was, you know, what do I, if I get my crystal ball out, what do I expect to happen to property prices? Well, I expect them to go up, and I think that's a reasonable expectation. And there's a really good website, actually. If you Google property prices, there's a data set that allows you to pick your period. And I think it goes back to 1960. I'm sure it's 1960. If we put the website in the show notes, Liz, that'd be great. And you can basically pick any date, literally any month. I think it goes down to each month. And look at what the average property price in the UK was. It's linked to Land Registry. And obviously it comes all the way up to present day with a 3 month lag. So you could get, start at quarter one this year, you could get that data really easy. And for me, if you look at that line, it just goes upwards. Yes, there's a couple of little blips, but you'd have to be an idiot to sell at the bottom of one of the blips because, you know, 99% of the time it's going upwards. And yes, it flattens off a bit. But if you look at, you know, this year versus this year or this year versus this year, we live on an island. We have more people being born than are passing away, bar a little blip because of COVID. We've got a net immigration into the country. So more people are coming in than going out. And people said, oh, that will change with Brexit. I don't think so, but, you know, maybe. And we've got divorce rate at 50-odd%. And that's the biggie. That's the one that people miss. We've got a family of four. So two kids and mum and dad that separate, And now you've got mum who needs three bedrooms, one for her and one for her two kids, one each for her two kids. And dad needs a bedroom for him and one each for his two kids because they share custody. And that is happening all over the country all of the time. So we have a massive shortage of properties. It always used to be 300,000 properties a year needed to be built. And consistently, we've built less than a third of that. And I think it's now gone up to 400,000. I think I read somewhere in some government paper that it's now gone up to 400,000. The target, but we've never hit it. And the crazy thing, I've said this before, the crazy thing is they say, yeah, we've got a 3-year target to build 300,000 a year. And so in my mind, you know, silly old me, 300,000 times 3 years, that's 900,000 houses. Yet they'd build, you know, 55,000 in year one. And they say, but we're on track for 300,000 next year. So we're back on track. And it's like, no, because we've just built 55,000 and we've got 845 to go. So now we have to build over 400,000 in the next 2 years. And it always seems to just slip and be ignored. But what that does is it forces up house prices. And we've seen massive house price growth over the last 12 months, despite an unprecedented weakness in the economy. So over 10 years, what do I expect to happen? I expect property prices to continue to climb. And there's always a reason why they won't, but they always seem to climb. I think fundamentally, the government recognise that people pay a lot of attention to their house prices, and a lot of people own houses, and a lot of those people vote. And so I don't think the government want to see a correction in house prices to the magnitude of 40 or 50%, which is what some experts say should happen to bring it back to 1960 affordability levels, etc. I just can't see that ever happening myself. Will we have a correction in the market? Yes, I think that's quite likely. We've seen unprecedented growth. It's been phenomenal over the last 12 or so months. And it's getting on towards 18 months now. And we were seeing pretty good capital growth before then. And so could we see a flattening off? Definitely. Could we see a drop in prices? Definitely. But, you know, even though the media will jump up and down and say, oh, this is a, you know, a housing crash, etc., it could be 2%, it could be 5%, it could be 10%. All of those are quite normal in a property cycle. And if you look, we are due for a correction. We are due for a cooling of the property market because it has been pretty aggressive for quite some time. And of course, London has seen that with people leaving London and apartments becoming less desirable, etc. And of course, there are other factors like the Grenfell factor of people not being able to sell their high-rise apartments and stuff. So there's a lot at play. For what it's worth, my crystal ball, I think we'll see a correction. We may not see lots of capital growth over the next 12, 24 months, but then those external macroeconomic factors will kick in and we'll see further growth. The follow-up question that people often ask at that point is, yeah, but hang on, Frank, if this is £1 million property and you want to get, you know, you want to get a 25% discount on it, that's got to go up to £1.33 million. What if there's not 35% growth in the next 10 years? Well, typically you see around 100% growth in 10 years, but of course there's no guarantee of that at all, and I definitely wouldn't rely on it. And it depends where in the country you are. It depends, you know, we could be at war at that point. That could have a massive impact. We could have industrial action. We could have another pandemic. We could have anything can happen in the next 10 years. You know, something that we talk about, black swan events. Well, they seem to come around quite regularly, but everyone's super surprised each time they come around. And that's a great book, by the way. It's by a guy called Taleb, The Black Swan Effect by, I'm going to struggle with his first name. I want to say Nicholas Taleb, but Taleb is his surname. Really good book, actually, talking about these events that we really should be expecting, that he calls black swan events. And the idea is, it's a bit like, you know, a turkey gets fed on day one in America and says, cool, this is good. And then he gets fed on day two and, cool, this is brilliant. And on day 1,000, he's like, this is brilliant. I love this. I just sit around, I get fed every day. And of course, day 1,001, it's Thanksgiving and he doesn't have quite as good a day. And it's that theory that just because things have been this way in the past doesn't, you know, is no predictor of future performance, as all the investment adverts say. And we should be mindful that that might not happen. So whilst I'm saying I expect capital growth to happen, definitely not, you know, if we've had 8 property cycles in the last 80 years, and I'm making that number up, should we rely on a 9th in the next 10 years? No, not at all. And that's where people then start to get nervous and they go, well, what are you going to do? You're going to be stuck with an exchange of contracts on this property, on these 4 properties. But we won't. And the reason for that is we're not in the business of taking risks. We're like an insurer almost, you know, heads we win, tails we don't lose. That's the principle of sophisticated property investing. So the way that we mitigate that risk of only, let's say there's only 10% growth in the next 10 years, you know, perhaps we have a catastrophic 20% drop in values in the next 2 years. Some pundits were predicting that. I don't think many are now. But let's just say that £1 million property today, we exchange contracts and we're going to buy it for £1 million. It becomes 800 grand in 2 years' time. That wouldn't look great, would it? Because you've got 8 years left now, so you've got less time left. And you've got now a £550,000 increase on an 800 grand property. That's looking unlikely. But let's say it only recovers to 1.1 million. We will make the exchange of contracts assignable. And what that means is we can just assign them to a third party. We can put those properties on the open market. We can sell them at 1.1 million, or if we needed to get rid of them quickly, 1.05 million. And we can pocket the difference. We can make the 100 grand, the 50 grand. And everything's been great. We've made 10 years of income on the property. We have cashed in at the end. Heads we win, it goes up and it's worth £2 million and we're quids in. Tails, it doesn't go up very much at all. We don't lose because we can just sell them on the open market. So I do predict decent capital growth. I do expect a correction in the short term, decent capital growth over the medium to long term. But we are protecting ourselves against any likely outcome. And, you know, could that property be worth 100 grand in 10 years' time? Yeah, it could. But I've probably got bigger things to worry about than completing on that property, if that's the case. So it's a case of, you know, hoping for the best, protecting against the worst, and then finding your attitude to risk in the middle.
Going back to the second part of the question.
I knew I'd forget the second part. Thanks, Liz. So if we buy these properties, what kind of lending will we use on them? Yeah, well, it depends. It depends on my cash position at the time. You know, that changes from month to month, depending on what deals we're doing, what we sell, what we buy, what developments we're doing, etc. It depends on the economy. So if I'm foreseeing a shortening of lending and a tightening of criteria, then I'll make sure I'm more cash positive, I'll make sure I'm more liquid so that we can capitalize on a tightening market and on a surplus of sellers. If I'm forecasting that lending's loosening, the market's becoming more buoyant, then I'll be happy to run with lower cash reserves. So it depends on how much cash we have at that time. It also depends on the rest of our portfolio. And this is the bit that I said was relevant to you, Liz. Too many investors get to a level where they are comfortable and they've learned the basics. And the danger in sophisticated property investing is you learn the basics. So you learn, which is what you've done, you learn how to buy properties at 75% of market value. So you learn how to find the vendors, you learn how to talk to the vendors, you learn how to sign them up, you learn how to buy the properties, you learn how to refinance them, and you're happily churning out, as you say, you know, 8 properties already this year, probably 10 or 12 by the end of the year. And if you do that over a 5 or 10 year period, let's do it over 10 years, you've got 100 properties at that point, 10 properties a year, 10 years. The massive mistake that I have seen people make, and that's why I wanted to share it with you, Liz, in case I haven't done previously, is investors that get into a bit of a rut. And you think, well, there are worse ruts to be in. There definitely are, but it's still a habit. There's nothing wrong with a rut if it's, you know, a healthy habit, but it's when that habit is done without thinking. So if that investor that bought 100 properties over 10 years bought them all at 75% loan to value and had a 75% loan to value mortgage on all of them, firstly, you definitely don't want them all the same lender. You want as many different lenders as possible, even if some of them are at 6%, some of them are at 3%. You want a real spread of lenders. Ideally, you want some in limited companies. You might have some in personal names. You might have some in, you know, a spouse's name, etc. Again, to give you some diversity. But you would still be exposed at quite a high loan to value. And what I would say, looking at that kind of a portfolio, and I've coached so many successful investors that are actually hanging on by the skin of their teeth or have gone under because they've over leveraged. And with one property, when you buy your first property, let's say you're earning 50 grand a year, 100 grand a year. If you have one mortgage that's costing you 300 quid a month and the interest rates increase to the point that it becomes 600 quid a month, it's not the end of the world with a decent salary. You just put the extra 300 in a month, you know, and at some point it will go cash flow positive again because rents will creep upwards and interest rates will come down. But with 100 properties, all of a sudden it's not £300 a month. It's not £3,000 a month, which might be, you know, if you quit all your gym memberships and you cancelled your Netflix and stuff, you might be able to, you know, on 50 or probably not on 50, but on 100 grand salary, you might be able to, you know, save 3 grand a month to keep your mortgages being paid. But at 100 properties, that's £30,000 a month increase. So they were already at 30 grand a month, your mortgages, but the rents were covering them and you were making a bit of money. But now with interest rates going up, you're now paying an additional £30,000 that you're having to find. You're not many investors are going to be able to. And what most investors say is, well, I'll just sell something. But what they miss is when interest rates are going through the roof, normally we're in the bottom of a property market and so no one's buying. Or everyone's trying to sell and there aren't enough buyers. And so it's very easy to think, oh, I could just sell a few. But no, you need to sell a few when the market's buoyant in order to have cash in the bank, coming back to my, you know, how liquid you need to be, have cash in the bank so that if something goes wrong, you've got, you know, 24, 36, 48 months worth of mortgage payments available to cover your potential increases in mortgage payments. And so how do you do that? Well, in a nutshell, you sell. You sell some of your properties, and it's very easy to theoretically do this. So you've got 100 properties and they've all got, let's keep them, maths easy, £100,000 properties, right? So you've got 100 properties, 100K each, and the mortgages on all those are 75 grand each. Let's keep it simple. If you sell 50 properties, that's going to bring in 25 grand on every property. So for every three you sell, you can pay off the mortgage on another one. And so you could, at an extreme, now I'm not suggesting this, but at one end of the spectrum, you've got 100 properties at 75% loan to value. You could actually sell off 75 and have 25 properties with no mortgages on them. Now, I wouldn't suggest you do that, but that at least gives you the two ends of the spectrum. And I think it's for everyone to decide where do they feel comfortable? Where's their balance between aggressively buying? Because now you're only going to get capital growth over 25 properties instead of over 100 and potentially losing them all and you know, being repossessed on everything if you can't cover the payments. And perhaps it would be, maybe you'd have 25% with a 75% loan to value, and maybe you'd have 12 or so that are paid off completely. Or it might be that, you know, you've got 5 paid off completely and the rest on 75% loan to value mortgages. It doesn't really matter, but it's important not to sleepwalk into a very precarious position. I did a really in-depth training session with some partners recently, actually, where I described doing the same transaction, the same type of purchase, the same monetization on the same type of property in the same geographic area over and over and over is like building a really tall building on a really small foundation. It's like a Jenga tower, and just keep putting the same blocks on and on and on, compared to investing in different types of properties in different parts of the country with different monetization strategies that you've purchased in different ways over different time periods using different lenders and having some of them unencumbered, etc. That is like building a really broad foundation and a two-story building on it. It's really solid. Nothing's going to blow it over. Nothing is never going to just topple over. And that's the challenge for people who are successful. People that are successful in sophisticated property investing often plow into too many transactions over time without actually realizing that they are ramping up their risks massively, because your ability to go and get a job and pay for that increase in mortgages diminishes with every property you buy. So it's a tricky one. So if I'm buying those four and I bought one 10 years before, how would I mortgage them? Well, it depends. I might buy them all on 75% mortgages at that point, as in buy them cash and then refinance them onto 75% mortgages. Or I might sell one, even if they've gone up to £2 million, you know, even if they've doubled in value, I might sell one and use that to bring my loan to value on the other ones down a bit. So I might, you know, then get 60% mortgages or 50% loan to value mortgages. Or the rest of my portfolio might be at a really low loan to value. I'm bringing the loan to value of my portfolio down quite a lot at the moment. I'm paying off some of my mortgages. Now, this is the other thing. You don't want to pay off all of your portfolio by 1%. So you don't want to pay off, you know, a lot of mortgages will allow you to pay off up to 10% of your mortgage in any given year, even on a fixed rate. But if you pay every mortgage off by 1%, you can't access that cash very readily at all, because the cost of refinancing is greater than the 1%. It's not a bad thing to do, but it's not the best thing to do. Whereas if you put all that money into one property and paid the mortgage off completely, you've now got an unencumbered property that in a hurry you could refinance, you get 50% on it really quick, get bridging on it if you needed to, or you can sell it. Even if you sold it at a low price, even if you whacked it into an auction and got 60%, 70% of what it's worth, you can liquidate that money really quickly, which is what you might need in an emergency of interest rates. You know, interest rates hit, I think they hit 15.8%, something like that, just before my consciousness about investing was around. You know, I think it was in the 80s, I think. Could that happen again? Yeah. We used to marvel at Japan and the fact that they'd had, you know, 0%, 0.1%, 0.5% interest rates for decades, and say, you know, that's so odd. Well, look at us. That's what we've got now. So hopefully that's given you an insight, Liz. I know it's not this is what we will do, but it certainly is this is what we'll consider when we come to buy.
So hopefully that's gone through quite a few of the questions people might have been thinking of. And if anybody does have any further questions, they can always hop onto our YouTube channel and go into the comments section, and we'll always go through the comments, answer them. If you've got suggestions, it's always great to hear from you. Other than that, we'll look forward to seeing you all soon.
Bye.
That was the Sophisticated Property Investing Podcast from Ethical Property Partners. Use your podcast app to follow or subscribe so you never miss an episode.